You're listening to By the Well, a lectionary-based podcast for preachers recorded on the land of the Wurundjeri people. Hi folks, it's Fran Barber here.
And me, Kylie Crabb.
Happy New Year, everyone. It's beginning of Advent and the start of a new lectionary year, the year of Luke. And we're so excited to tell you that we've expanded the By the Well team with new co-hosts. So it's a brave new world. Robin and I will still be around, but we're adding several scholars and ministers to bring you a greater diversity of voices. You'll meet others in the weeks ahead, but we're so glad that Kylie Crabb has joined us as one of our guests.
Great to be here.
For those who don't know Kylie, she's a Uniting Church minister and senior research fellow at Australian Catholic University, where she works on Luke Acts, on disability and identity in the Bible, on apocalyptic literature and much more. You've been a guest so many times, but welcome to the team officially, Kylie.
Thanks, Fran. It's always a pleasure.
So this week we're focusing on Psalm 25, verses 1 to 10, maybe going a bit further into the psalm, and Luke 21, 25 to 36. And obviously we're coming off the back of Christ the King last week, or the reign of Christ, however you want to call it, when we talked a lot about apocalyptic literature, I suppose, and apocalyptic signs and the strangeness of that language and the expectation and the waiting and the hope.
Yeah, and so I'm quite curious, Fran, to hear how it feels. You follow the lectionary through week by week here, and like moving off this this festival last week with the reign of Christ into Advent, what does that transition feel like, or what does it make you notice about Advent?
Well, it makes me second guess people's tendency to perhaps move straight on to the preparation for Christmas and all the focus on the baby in the manger. That this is a time of great waiting and expectation and a time of tremendous hope as we wait for the inbreaking of Christ.
Yes. Yeah. It's interesting to me about that. I mean, maybe especially in the year of Luke, when you've got like two whole chapters that are tracing the infancy of John the Baptist and Jesus and the pregnancies of Mary and Elizabeth, that it's sort of tempting to think of Advent as just being a kind of like we immediately equate the waiting with pregnancies or with the kind of waiting for Jesus's birth rather than what it really is, right, which is a time of waiting for the inbreaking of God, as you say, in terms of the parousia, expecting the second coming or expecting God's final culmination
or
of justice.
Revelation.
Or,
yes. Yeah. No, we talked last week about, you know, apocalypse as meaning to reveal, make naked, literally. Yeah. And that, I suppose, speaking as Christians now as we come into the time of Advent, that the focus of that revelation is on the person of Christ and the cosmic implications of that. Well, actually, the cosmic, but obviously the deeply ordinary and personal that touches on as well. So
we'll, a time of eschatological expectation over the coming weeks.
Indeed. Yep. No pressure on us to, you know,
bear see what can be revealed.
Yeah. So let's begin with the psalm, Kylie. A couple of things that I just found interesting that aren't complicated about this psalm, but that it's an acrostic one, which means that each line corresponds to a letter in the Hebrew alphabet, which I think is super cool just in terms of a kind of a teaching or a learning or a memory tool for people to learn to pray it and depth it, you know, so that it's really coming from the heart, written on the heart.
Each line starting with that next letter. Yeah, it was fantastic.
I did read something else too about the use of language and how here is quite deliberate in terms of that memory learning tool, and that's what they called hinge words. So you'll have the word put to shame, the word shame in verse 2, for example, and then it's repeated, the same Hebrew words repeated, but perhaps a slightly different form of the word.
Yep.
But that this happens with the word shame and with walking with God and so on.
Yes, and remembering maybe too.
And yes, that was it. And remembering and walking,
Yeah, good. It's an interesting psalm, I think, with also this sense of, yes, being taught to walk in on the Lord's paths of righteousness. So we have this kind of interesting dynamic. There's this sense of waiting, which is obviously part of the connection to Advent here. But something about also sort of how we live in the waiting. Like there's quite a focus on being instructed by Yahweh, that this itself is a gift, that there's this prayer for being instructed, the need for teaching, and that this then leads into the experience of mercy. I don't know, I found it actually quite beautiful. It's sort of this circular idea of being, because we might think of the waiting as being waiting on some kind of judgment or some kind of scary thing, which of course we're not wanting to kind of say, oh, it's all domesticated and easy. But actually that the very thing that helps us to walk with Yahweh during this time of waiting is itself a gift of God.
What did you think? Well, no, I was thinking also, it's also not about some special knowledge or enlightenment that you're going to achieve. You know, it's actually in that process of engaging in relationship with God, which here is the walking and the learning, and that process or that relationship itself is salvation.
Yeah.
So that you experience the mercy and the love and the faithfulness of God when you engage in this prayer to God, this very prayer the psalmist has written, but in that process of active waiting and anticipation.
Yeah. There's something kind of... it almost feels like a conflict, but it's not, of thinking about that and in light of Advent and that sense of waiting, that we're waiting on God, and yet it is that experience itself that is the walk of discipleship and something. Yeah.
Well, it's a bit like people saying, isn't it, ministry is the interruptions. That is, you know,
yes.
That what we think is interfering with the thing is the thing.
Yeah,
you know, which is what's being said here. Now, I understand why we cut off the lectionary where we do. I'm always critiquing it. But I am interested in the verse 22 at the end of this psalm, redeem Israel, O God, out of all its troubles. I'm just interested because the fragment that we're given does make it kind of a personal, individual prayer, and it isn't. You only have to read a bit carefully to see that the pronouns actually shift in verse 2, oh my God, in you I trust, do not let me be put to shame. And then in verse 3, do not let those who wait for you be put to shame. So there is a shift, but I just found the loss of that verse 22, that for me really does show us that it's communal.
Yes.
And national, and it's all about the breaking down of systems and everything that we did talk about last week with regard to Christ the King.
Yeah. Yep.
Which was last year.
Indeed, lecturally speaking. Right, exactly. Exactly. No, I actually read in preparation for this conversation some of Howard Wallace's commentary on Psalms and found that quite helpful. He also really drew that connection out, and of course he's also wanting to think about this as being put in the kind of the voice of David, and so there's this sense of the I who is David, but we might of course also identify with that I, but that the I then also becomes us, and so there is this automatic kind of invitation into being a communal meditation on faithfulness, on how we walk together as a gift of Yahweh who is merciful. And in fact, Howard has this great line in it that where he says also, who Yahweh is makes such waiting possible, which I thought was beautiful reflection on the way that the psalm draws out the character of God, and that this is what enables our discipleship in the first place.
Yes, and it's also this is a description of how we are to be with God. It's sort of like it's a revelation of the right stance that we're to have before God and who we are before God. So there's something about the psalm itself being that revelation as well as pointing to how we might see it.
Yeah, but not like you were saying before, not like a test or something.
No.
Because, in fact, it is – the one before whom we stand is the one who makes it possible for us to be there in the first place.
Now, I've been listening to Brené Brown's Dare to Lead and her stuff about shame, and so that meant for in terms of, you know, how this psalm begins, I was really struck by the use of the word shame in a way that I probably have just sort of coasted over before. And she draws this distinction between shame as and guilt. So shame is I am bad, and guilt is I've done something bad. Oh, she probably uses a better word than bad. But I've just struck me in this psalm how that's all here, you know. You know, don't let me be put to shame. Don't let me be bad. But then also there's stuff about transgressions and being forgiven. So part of the waiting is the being forgiven. Mm. And that she says the opposite of shame is actually is empathy, but it's connection.
Yeah.
So that I'm just reading all of that into this in terms of the desire for connection.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is here connection with one with God primarily, but also with one another, and indeed, yes, trying not to be connected to my enemies, which is.
Yeah, yeah, which is a
not so healthy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But there's something, it's such loaded language, right? Talking about, you know, a reading that uses language like shame and stuff, it's just so important that we can notice that language, I think. As I think also as Christian ministers, we might become accustomed to the language and use it and not think about how that lands for people in the congregation. The idea of being liberated from a sense of shame could actually be extremely powerful, and being able to think of the kind of repentance that we might see, the need for mercy as being separate from the, like the distinction you're drawing between have our sense of responsibility for times when we have gone wrong, when we've not been on the path of righteousness, or we've strayed, the difference between that and that embodied kind of deep sense of I'm
unworthy
bad.
I
am bad, that shame rather than guilt language.
But it's just also it struck me that the psalms do this all the time. They just touch so deeply the human condition, in their main focus being who is God and how is God with us. It's just they touch also on what is deeply human and therefore still deeply true now as when they were written.
True for us and true for how humans construct communities and how they might have hurtful stuff in our communities as well.
So Howard also does talk as well, doesn't he, about parts of this psalm that you could use liturgically if you were, well, if you were preaching on it, but also if you weren't and you were trying to incorporate it in the liturgy. Yeah. And he's got suggestions for prayers of confession and for declarations of forgiveness on his little website link, right, which I can put into the show notes.
Great.
Did you know you could join our Facebook group, By the Well, for extra content and discussion? Now, we may still touch on the psalm as we come to Luke, mightn't we, Kylie? I'm just wondering, as we embark on this new year, focusing on the Gospel according to Luke, can you just remind us what some key themes or tenets of Luke's are that we can hang some interpretation on?
Yeah, yep. There's lots of fun stuff to be read and thought through in Luke's Gospel, which makes for a good year ahead. Not that any of the lectionary years are not that. But, yeah, thinking about I've already kind of referred to one of them in terms of these first two chapters that we get with the infancy narratives. But one way of thinking about it might be that Luke has many, many beginnings. Keeps on – Mona Hooker says this. It's like he doesn't know how to stop doing introductions. So we get like a very first introduction with the dedication, and then we get the infancy narratives and then the ministry of John the Baptist. One that we might particularly also notice, I mean, all of those in their own ways are very important for how Luke continues, but that Luke brings forward the inauguration of Jesus's ministry at Nazareth to be a kind of first big event in Jesus's ministry. And we notice there are lots of things that are going to be characteristic for Jesus in Luke's gospel, stuff to do with that he says that the Spirit has anointed him to bring bring good news to the poor. He's about liberation of the oppressed. And we'll see that go through lots of different things, and the fact that it draws in heaps of controversy. So in Luke's gospel, we're going to get lots of stuff to do with insiders and outsiders, which is an important thing to notice. We'll see parables that might be some of your favorite parables that you don't hear elsewhere, some of which will also be on about insiders and outsiders, like the story of the two lost sons, and various other ones that we get these kind of comparison elements. And we might see some stuff to do with Jesus as being a rejected prophet and how that unfolds, all sorts of stuff to do with wealth, and much more.
Yes, so, yeah. Indeed. So that's a good little reminder summary for people.
Yep.
So the section that we've got today actually begins sort of in the middle, or quite 20 verses after the prompt.
Yes, that's right.
So I think it's chapter 21, verse 7, where Jesus is asked about the temple. And then
Jesus is asked a question by the disciples: when will these things be, and what will be the sign that they're about to happen? And then what we've got is that then a whole long speech ensues from Jesus, and we start in today's lectionary halfway through that speech.
Right, yes.
Yep.
So we've got, again, dramatic signs of the last things.
Yep.
I understand there is some controversy about whether this is sort of apocalyptic genre or not, but it's certainly cosmic. We've got the sun, the moon, the stars and the earth, distress among nations, roaring chaos in the sea, if you think about creation and Genesis 1. And so on. People fainting from fear and foreboding.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things to bear in mind, it would definitely be worth going back and reading from the start of this prophetic speech from Jesus, because what he's really doing is tracing through a whole lot of events. So previous to this, we'll get events that are very obviously to do with the destruction of Jerusalem. And then it moves into this. So this is a kind of prophecy that is designed to help the reader tell where they fit within a series of unfolding events, and to realize that if you pay attention to the signs, to realize that God's intervention, God's action, final action is imminent. So you'll be able to tell that that is about to happen if you kind of read through all of these signs and understand the codes, which I guess is one of the things we might really notice in Luke's gospel. People who studied Luke's gospel a while back might remember a kind of standard line about Luke, that Luke is all about the delayed parousia and doesn't worry about eschatology. But this is a thing that I especially would encourage people to kind of rethink a bit, because in fact – we get here heaps of eschatological expectation that is kind of imminent eschatological expectation. It's quite passionate, and not really just about delaying things at all, I don't think. But this is one of those controversial passages people might remember.
Yeah. I was reading a really interesting sermon from Craig Thompson about this, and he does use the word apocalypse or apocalyptic when he's looking at this sort of these verses from 25 to 28 particularly. But I found it quite interesting, because he talked about how popularly we understand apocalypse and an apocalyptic event as being, you know, obviously super dramatic, and there's kind of like a wasteland.
Yep.
You know, you think of movies that you might have seen. He talks about Apocalypse Now, but, you know, there's a wasteland, there's sort of a few people left wandering. But that it's really just a dramatic silence and a horror. Mm. But that biblically, it's not silence that comes after. This is about revelation of God. And so we're in fear appropriately, because it's before God, but that there will be this new thing, a new word will be spoken. And he talks about the resurrection being an apocalyptic category, and that this is the sign of the hope of God in the world in this radically new way, which sounds like I'm skipping ahead because we've just started Advent, but it's, you know, the Christ we understand in the light of that resurrection who we're talking about here.
Yeah, definitely. And that this kind of is a theme that holds together, right, that the resurrection is the beginning. There's this kind of sense in which, just in the way that the lectionary is a circle and we keep on going through that, that this is already or it's the now and not yet.
Yeah,
it's the already not yet already kind of thing.
Yeah. And that, you know, this is a pastoral word to the Lucan community who are suffering, you know, all sorts of trials and fears of the future and so on.
It's definitely a word about, like, this is, even if you think things have been delayed so far, that's delay in the past, and now we're still imminently expecting this intervention of God. I think one of the things that I find interesting about this passage and the set of things that are anticipated is, you know, there's all the drama, sort of like you're saying, Craig has been speaking about all the kind of drama that we might get in the last things, the eschatological signs. And then we get this bit that says, when you see these things, stand up straight and know that your redemption has come near. So, in fact, there's this kind of liberation that we see there that has been part of Luke's gospel throughout. And in fact, one of the things that might be worth doing is flicking back several chapters back to chapter 13 and looking at the story in verses 10 to 17 about a healing of a woman with a bent back, a woman who's bent over, and that she stands up in this same way. There's this sense of liberation that comes to people as they stand up straight and get this sense of the nearness of God's redemption. So it's all action, but then in another way, maybe this is what you were saying before, Fran, deeply personal.
Yeah, really sort of ordinary, but super important and life-changing.
Yeah. Is there anything else that stood out to you in this passage, Fran, that you wanted to draw our attention to?
I was wondering about this whole idea of waiting and expectation, that our talking about it will have been inevitably altered by the strange existence we've all been living over the last 20 months through a global pandemic. So we're speaking to people across the world at the moment, Kylie. So some, like those of us in Melbourne, have had extended periods of lockdown over 2 years when we thought it was all finished last year well, some of us really didn't think it was, but we were told it was. And others, you know, are facing new restrictions or we've been stuck at home basically. So we've been in this funny patch of endless days that look the same and sort of blur. There's been no markings.
Yeah.
And it's felt like time has flown when we've got to the end of it, but it's a weird lethargy and I'm just interested in, I mean, we're still processing that experience, and as you can tell, I'm still sort of trying to articulate it. But I think there's something in the preaching a sermon about waiting, what it says biblically here, what sort of waiting we're called to that the psalmist is talking about, the sort of waiting we've had, which is not nothing, like it's not cosmic, but then again it's been global.
Yes, yeah.
And then the sort of waiting that we've imposed as nations on refugees with, you know, no marking of when it might be over, at least with COVID restrictions, you're generally given some signposts of when things might change.
That definitely was that definitely struck me as well when I was thinking about waiting and different kinds of, like in the psalm, the different kind of fruitful ways of waiting, and then waiting as an imposition, as a form of oppression, actually, in how we have responded to people who've come to us seeking asylum, and the trauma and psychological damage that kind of interminable waiting with no signposts can cause. So I was wondering about preaching on waiting and how we reflect on the different kinds of waiting and how waiting can be fruitful. I think, yeah,
but feel like it's not as well.
Yes,
you know, I mean, that's what we were doing at Stuck at Home. It was fruitful in the sense that fewer people were getting sick and dying.
Yes,
yeah. You know, that's fruitful.
Yeah, yeah.
But it doesn't feel like it, and it feels despairing and so on. And I suppose
is that the kind of waiting that the psalm is talking about, though? That's what I was wondering, you know, like about how we live faithfully during that waiting time, that kind of being instructed in walking the path of righteousness as a kind of in the moment kind of.
As a merciful experience in and of itself.
Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, you know, the Christian hope being that the Christ is risen and sheds radical new light on this waiting for us, that we are in the not yet. There is profound chaos and disturbance and injustice, but God has been faithful in Christ and will be faithful, and that's our entering into that hope is to live that hope with one another and in our communities.
That sounds like a wonderful invitation to end on, I think, Fran.
Thanks for listening, folks.
By the Well is brought to you by Pilgrim Theological College and the Uniting Church in Australia. It's produced by Adrian Jackson. Thanks for listening.